of that passage he's affirming. Take Matthew 12:40. Just as, strong contrast in Greek, just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, even so I will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. If he is accommodating, then he is, you cannot believe him when he talks about his own death and resurrection, because he's basing it on the truth of that passage. A direct, strong contrast in the passage. 25 times in the Gospel of John, Jesus said, certainly, certainly, surely, surely, truly, truly, amen, amen, verily, verily, I say unto you. That doesn't sound like accommodation. How about, all authority in heaven and earth is given to me, therefore go. Sound like somebody's talking with authority. Even the scribes had to admit, this man speaks with authority, not as the scribes and the Pharisees, or the crowd, admitted that. So the accommodation theory is a beautiful theory ruined by a brutal gang of facts. I think we'll stop there, because I don't want to go any farther without you having the notes before you, and we'll pick up there in the morning at what time?
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. But to look back at the outline, we talked about the philosophical roots, and most of that we covered last night. In fact, we did. It's philosophical roots, Roman numeral 1 on the first page. And today we're really covering the theological fruit of this whole thing. But we have to move back to finish a little bit of the history to do it, because the anti-supernaturalism of Spinoza and David Hume gave fruit in terms of the early attacks on the Bible, which began with Spinoza himself, proceeded through Richard Simone on page 14. We talked about the father of higher criticism, and then Astruc, who talked about two authors in Genesis 1 and 2, Semler, page 18, and Eichhorn, the accommodation theory, and of course Eichhorn, 1752 to 1827, was the one who popularized the term higher criticism, which we use today, and who gave rise to the JEPD theory that was later incorporated and popularized by Wellhausen, by distinguishing between the Jehovahist and the Eloist and priestly forms of the literature in the Pentateuch, and then giving rise to the view that there were really five different authors. We run in Serge Schleiermacher at this point, the life and works of Friedrich Schleiermacher, 1768 to 1834. He's a very important figure because he's the father of modern liberalism. And these two books by Schleiermacher, you ought to consider liberal classics and put them on your list to get around to reading as soon as you can. On Religion, 1799, is an experimental approach, and the Christian faith is a doctrinal approach. He was educated as a Moravian Pietist. He was ordained and preached in Berlin. He taught theology there as well, which shows that Pietism, which by the way is the religious background that most of us come from, Baptistic religions are Pietistic. Pietism gave rise to rationalism, and very godly people, children, became these rationalists and liberals. And so you got to be very careful with Pietism. If Pietism is not trained in systematic theology and stresses only the experiential approach, I've been born again, I've had an experience with God, you know, everything from the charismatic movement through, let's say, the Southern Baptists is Pietistic. And that movement is very dangerous if untrained. Why is it there's a Mormon temple in Dallas? Why is it in the buckle of the Bible Belt the Mormons have a strong foothold? It's because in the Bible Belt they have just enough Bible to make them religious and not enough theology to make them discerning. My statement about the Bible Belt, having lived and taught in the South for almost 20 years now, is that the Bible Belt doesn't have much Bible under its belt. And it has even less theology under its belt, and consequently, it's susceptible to religious deception. Somebody comes along like the Mormons, and they can build a temple right in our backyard here, because liberalism and rationalism and higher criticism grew in pietism. I remember a number of my students who come from Plymouth Brethren background, another pietistic background, who were told, you know, you don't ask questions like that, you don't study theology, you don't study philosophy, you know, just have this experience with Christ. That works except with people who want to think. That works except with people who want answers. And those young people went away to schools, and they were easy prey for liberals because they gave them intellectual ammunition, intellectual answers, unfortunately, the kind that undermined their faith. Schleiermacher is a perfect example of this. In fact, even Bultmann, as liberal as he was, Bultmann attended Sunday school, took his kids to Sunday school, went to church, was very pietistic in his belief, and yet he didn't believe anything in the Gospels was true, except maybe there was a Jesus who once lived, you know, and the rest is all mythological. Schleiermacher is the fountainhead of that, and he influenced a lot of people, but the influences on him were one, pietism, which stresses devotion over doctrine, romanticism, which stressed pantheism versus theism, and pietism falls right into the hands of pantheism. In fact, if you want to see a good example of that, take a witness, Witness Lee and Watchman Nee. Witness Lee is very pietistic, deeper meaning of scripture, and then the next generation, Witness Lee, he was into heretical views on the Trinity and everything because he didn't have any theological structure to keep him from going into those heretical views. And as we all know, if you've done a study of the Word of Faith movement, the radical end of the charismatic movement, which is totally experience-oriented, getting messages from God, you end up with kooks like Benny Hinn. You have nine people in the Trinity. God the Father has a body. Jesus went to hell and was born again. Adam was an astronaut. Women were supposed to have babies out their sides. I mean, where do you get this from? Obviously not the Bible. Now you get it because you have a totally experientially oriented religion with no categories of true and false, right and wrong, logic that filters all of these absurd things through, plus no historical understanding of theology and orthodoxy, and no systematic theology to put everything in. So it easily tends to that end of the spectrum. Also, agnosticism, Immanuel Kant, the practical is more important than the theoretical. Since you cannot know God by reason, you can at least posit God. So Immanuel Kant didn't turn out to be an atheist. He was a philosophical agnostic, but he was a theological deist. He posited God because God is useful for our practical life. You can't think about God, you can't know God, but you must posit him and live as though there were a God, and he believed there was. Now, Schleiermacher's view on religion is summarized in these next points. The basis of religion is in experience. You must have it before you can utter it. The locus of religion is in the self. The inner is the key to the outer. It's inside of you. The object of all religion is the all, which you call God. Basically, he was a pantheist. And it's interesting that the father of modern biblical criticism was a pantheist, Spinoza. God is all is God, same thing as Shirley MacLaine, the New Age movement. And the father of liberalism was a pantheist, Schleiermacher. God is the all. We have to depend on the all. The nature of religion, a feeling or sense of absolute dependence. A religious person is someone who feels dependent on the all. He has a sense of dependence. So notice it's centered in feeling. Now, not necessarily emotion. Don't equate feeling emotion. The German word for feeling here is a lot broader and deeper. It means a sense of, an awareness of, a deep-seated inner cognizance that you are dependent on God, the whole universe. So it's a sense of creaturehood, an awareness that one is dependent on the all, or a sense of existential contingency, that you are contingent in your very existence. In order to understand what he means by religion, you have to distinguish three things: ethics, science, and religion. According to Schleiermacher, ethics is a way of living, science is a way of thinking, and religion is a way of feeling. Ethics is a way of acting, science is a way of knowing, but religious feeling is a way of being or sensing. Ethics is practical, science is contemplative, and religion is attitudinal. Science is a rationalization about this, and religion is centered in intuition. Ethics is a matter of self-control, but religion is a matter of self-surrender. And the important thing is, after he spelled this all out, which is really kind of the beginnings of modern phenomenology, you're beginning with a phenomenological analysis of religious experience, which is what I wrote my doctoral dissertation on, and then you work your way out from that. So religion is related to doctrine the way sound is related to an echo. Doctrine is just an echo of true religious experience. Doctrine is just an expression, but the reality is in the experience. Doctrine is just a form, religion is the feeling. Doctrine is the structure, religion is the stuff. Doctrine is just stating, religion is sensing. And by making that bifurcation between those two things, he shifted the focus from orthodox doctrine, from the orthodox creeds and orthodox theology, to unorthodox religious experience. Because if you have experience apart from doctrine, it'll go in every direction. I mean, it's like pouring water out on a table. There's no container to hold it. It doesn't have any form, any structure to it. And so if once you buy into this premise it's all over. Doctrine is not essential to religious experience, and it scarcely is necessary to expressing it. You can even express it in ritual. You don't need doctrine. Not only is doctrine not important, it's not essential, you can get along without any doctrine at all, as long as you have an experience. Experience is the important thing, and you can act it out. You can symbolize it. You can have religious symbols, religious actions. You don't even need doctrine to express this feeling. The universality of religion, all men have this religious feeling. He kind of anticipates Paul Tillich here, that everybody has a sense of ultimate commitment. From Schleiermacher to Paul Tillich, you just have a series of footnotes. A sense of the ground of being. I have a feeling that I'm grounded, and there is an ultimate, and I make an ultimate commitment to it, said Paul Tillich. Same thing Schleiermacher is talking about here. Everybody has it, even an atheist. Atheist feels. In fact, Sigmund Freud said he had the same feeling. But he said, I reject it. I reject that feeling. That's a bad thing, and I want to establish my own independence. I don't want a cosmic comforter, a heavenly Linus blanket. I don't want to be in a cosmic neurosis the rest of my life, said Sigmund Freud. That's terrible. That's bad stuff. I want to do something about that feeling. I want to grow up and put away my Linus blanket and my little lollipop, depending on this father comforter, and do it on my own. Communication. How do we communicate this religious feeling? Primary communication. Religion is better caught than taught. And now notice that shifts the emphasis from informational type or catechistical type religious experience, where you catechize, you inform, you indoctrinate, you teach people truths. No, just let them catch it. Don't teach it, it's better caught than taught. Secondary, through symbols. Doctrines are accounts of religious feelings. They are statements about our feelings, not about God, his attributes, or nature. So religion is reduced to an experience. Doctrine at best is secondary or tertiary, not essential, and what it does is it's a statement about how you feel. It's not really a statement about God. That's Kant, see? That's that bifurcation between reality, between the noumenal world and the phenomenal world. between the way a thing is in itself and the way it is to me. Varieties of religious experience. There are endless varieties due to personality differences. You want to read a book on that, read William James, Varieties of Religious Experience. Pantheistic system, those who delight in the obscure tend to formulate their religious experience in pantheistic terms. Those who delight in the definite, they tend to be theists. Truth. Truth and falsity do not apply to religion as such, but only to ideas. There's no true religion and false religious experience. There are true ideas and false ideas. The aim of religion, the love of world spirit, is another pantheistic term for God, through loving men. So we exhaust our love for God through our love for others. There is no vertical love for God over and above our love for others. The result, unity of life. The influence of religion on ethics, it produces a wholeness of life. No specific influence on individual acts. We act with religion, not from it. Science, one cannot be scientific without piety, that is, dependence, because this removes the presumption to knowledge, which is ignorance. The true goal of science can't be realized without a vision arising from religion. So Schleiermacher's entire approach gave rise, if you look at point four here, to not only liberalism, which he's the father of, but he influenced most liberal thinkers after him, including Albert Ritschl, 1822 to 1889, Critical History of the Christian Doctrine of Justification. That's one of the seminal works on a liberal view of justification. And Adolf von Harnack, What is Christianity? That's a classic liberal treatment. He was one of the great liberal historians. And Julius Wellhausen, 1844 to 1918, The Introduction to the History of Israel, which he wrote 1878, just 7 years after Darwin, said almost the same thing in The Descent of Man about religion evolving from animistic to polytheistic, henotheistic, and monotheistic stages. So Schleiermacher was exceedingly important. Now, if you look back at page 16 here, that moves us on to people like Paulus. We mentioned last night, and I may have left the wrong impression here last night, which I'd like to correct now, that the first major desupernaturalized work on the life of Christ was by Strauss, and it really was by Paulus in 1828, except he was a little more mild. He wrote The Life of Jesus, and in it he tried to defend the substantial authenticity of the Gospels, but he couldn't get away from his personal disbelief in miracles. So you see a liberal in transition here. I'd like to believe a lot of this is true, but I can't believe in miracles. So he struggled to explain how miracles got in this record, and he attempted to turn miracles into ordinary facts and events. This is the fountainhead of the belief that, say, the feeding of 5,000 was the little boy got his lunch out, everybody else was shamed, they got their lunch out, and before you know it, you got enough to feed 5,000 people. Those kind of explanations began right here in Paulus, because he wanted to believe that it was authentic and there's truth and these people aren't deliberately distorting the record, but at the other hand he couldn't quite swallow the miracles. So he influenced people like Strauss, who later wrote a systematic critical desupernaturalized version of the life of Christ. Then there was a guy named DeWitt, 1790 to 1849. He was a radical rationalist and anti-supernaturalist. You can see the evolution occurring here. He was heavily influenced by Schleiermacher, whom we just studied. And if you look on the top of page 17, he reduced the stories of the birth, resurrection, and ascension of Christ to myths. Here's the first systematic demythologization work. The employment of myths was DeWitt's attempt to absolve the biblical writers from charges of lunacy and imbalance by contending that they prosaically turned metaphor and allegory into fact as they wrote. Now, it's pretty hard to absolve the biblical writers from that, but you see, they want to cling to Christianity. They want a kind of mere Christianity here that keeps the experience, that keeps the real Jesus, that keeps what's important to Christianity, and yet explains all of this higher criticism, which they're obligated to do in the light of modern anti-supernaturalism. David Strauss came along, and he wrote under the influence of Schleiermacher and Hegel, Leben Jesu, 1835-1836, the myth theory was applied to the gospel record, denying the historical foundation of all supernatural elements in the gospel. He assigned them to an unintentionally created myth. So these disciples are just kind of sincerely exaggerating, sincerely embellishing the documents, and that produced all of the miracle accounts that never happened. Followed by Graf, Kunin, and Julius Wellhausen, 1844 to 1918. Now these people picked up on what their predecessors had said, coming right out of Spinoza, who was the first to propose that Ezra composed the law, the whole Old Testament, and they started to formulate it into very systematic and, quote, scholarly and, quote, scientific treatments of the Old Testament. On the bottom of page 17, their works are noted. Of course, the work there by Wellhausen was perhaps the most popular, the composition of the Hexateuch, the first six books of the Old Testament, Pentateuch being the first five, 1876, and the introduction to the history of Israel. Notice what Gleason Archer says here. Although Wellhausen contributed no innovation to speak of, he restated the documentary theory with great skill and persuasiveness, supporting the JEPD sequence upon an evolutionary basis. And he talks about the animism we referred to. When I was at Harvard and gave that lecture I mentioned last night, I opened it for questions. The only question I got, well, it might have been another question, but the first question I got was on higher critical views of the Old Testament, you know, JEPD or something like that, some technical question. And I answered it by saying, well, let me just quote one of your own graduates, Harvard PhD, from this very institution. I quoted Gleason Archer in support of the conservative view, and I got no more questions on that issue from the Harvardites. Gleason Archer, in my opinion, is one of the greatest living Old Testament scholars, a man who knows 30 languages. He starts on the first day of the month and reads his devotions in Arabic and ends on Zambia or whatever, on Z on the last day of the month. He uses a different language every day, reads the Bible. He is the most brilliant Old Testament linguist I've ever met by far and away. And he has written an excellent book, Survey of Old Testament Introduction, where you can get answers to a lot of these things, and his critique of JEPD is devastating. Well, since that time, just roughly here, higher criticism since Wellhausen, 1918 to the present, of course it spread from Europe to England and from England to the United States. Fortunately, in those days, communication was a little slower, so it took about a whole generation later for it to get roots over here in our country, and whereas they were pretty well shot by the turn of the century, 1900, it didn't take over completely here until almost 1930, so it took almost a full generation to do it. And you can kind of pinpoint that with a couple events. One is the Scopes trial, 1925. That was a very crucial turning point. So from 1900, when every major institution in America was still officially Orthodox, in the year 1900. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, they all still were Trinitarian. So from the 1640s to 1900, you still had officially Trinitarian statements. Then they had sent their teachers to Europe. They studied under all these scholars. They came back, and just before the 1900s, they themselves were convinced of this Darwinian, anti-supernatural trend in Europe. They came back and started teaching it, and then between 1900 and 1930, the great battles took place in our universities, and we lost everyone to liberalism. Every major Eastern institution, 106 of 108, of which were evangelical to begin with, we lost between 19, and by 1930, they were all completely liberal. So in one generation, from 1900 to 1930, we lost the whole battle in our institutions. And of course, after that, we had to start new institutions, new Orthodox and conservative institutions. Westminster broke away from Princeton. G. Gretchen Machen left. Dallas Seminary was started. Other institutions arose. And of course, Wheaton College became the founding head of training a lot of young evangelicals. And now, and then by 1940, what was it, 46 or 47, Carl Henry wrote his book, The Uneasy Conscience of Evangelicals. We've lost the battle. We got to get back in the battle. He made the cry for scholarship and to get back in from 47 to today, which is we're approaching 1997 rather rapidly. In that 50 years, we have gained a lot of ground back because we have produced numerous scholars, PhDs, the Evangelical Theological Society, all of whom believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, has grown to somewhere around 2,000 members. When I started 45 years ago, you could count on one hand, less than one hand, people had PhDs in philosophy. Carl Henry and Jellema and Carnell and Gordon Clark and one or two others. Now I could tell you at least a dozen of or 20 of my former students who have PhDs in philosophy, some from Oxford, some from University of Chicago, who still believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, let alone, you know, hundreds of others. There are two organizations of Christian philosophers alone, Society of Christian Philosophers and Evangelical Philosophical Society, for people who are sharp intellectually and still are committed to the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible. Just to give you a word of encouragement after all of this. Well, the next period here, in the next few pages, which I want to skip over quickly and you can read later, are periods where we had a development, two developments are going on. One, on top of page 20, the Bultmannian development, Bultmann, that I'm going to speak more of later, so I'll pass over that now, and then of course the existential or neo-orthodox thing in Karl Barth, which we'll say a good deal about. But let me finish the history here of biblical criticism starting on page 22 by going over to New Testament criticism and seeing how this worked its way out in the New Testament. The history of liberal criticism is the history of historical criticism, and it begins with a view called historical criticism. And there were three areas they were interested in: the techniques of dating documents, verification of events contained in those documents. Notice the presupposition behind that: they need to be verified, that's guilty till proven innocent, and the writing of history, the reconstruction of events and their expansion. So this historical criticism grew during this entire period, largely with Germans, and there were a few scholars who resisted it. Notice in the bottom of that paragraph, George Salmon, Theodor von Zahn, and R.H. Lightfoot were three notable scholars who resisted this trend, so there was a minority of evangelicals even as it was growing. That gave rise to source criticism, also known as literary criticism, which attempts to discover and define the literary sources used by biblical writers. Now that's interesting. If Matthew wrote Matthew, and he was a disciple, and Mark